Welcome to Sport Bible Stories. I'm Rory Jennings.
And I'm Maz Mirza there.
And today we welcome the one and only Mark Clattenburg onto the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Top dog, I love it.
Thank you so much for joining us, Mark.
No problem.
Really appreciate it.
No, it's great to have you. And of course, we've got to start. You left the Premier League in 2017. What was your reason behind leaving? Because even like, we were chatting to Tony Pulis, you know, he said he's begging you to stay.
Is that what he said?
Yeah. He said that.
Wow,
you never said that to me.
You told me that. What was the decision? Why did you make that decision?
You know what? I was officiating the best league in the world. The Premier League is the best league in the world for excitement. So if I'm going for footballing reasons, then I've made the wrong decision. However, you're not got a big future in refereeing. Refereeing can be, you can end your career the next week, bad performances, you can lose your contract in the Premier League, you can stop refereeing matches abroad and you're refereeing FIFA. So you've got a short lifespan. So I've got to look after my family. So I had an opportunity to go to Saudi Arabia for a lot more money. It gives us a new challenge because I'd just refereed many big matches around the world and I'd done every Premier League game. So therefore, I needed a new challenge. Saudi Arabia give us that challenge, but probably like Cristiano Ronaldo will probably say now, except he'll be talking a bit more about more money. But in general, it's a challenge and I took that challenge. So to leave the Premier League, it was sad because you had characters like Tony Pulis, you know, Neil Warnock. These type of managers were great banter to have around and, you know, they appreciated good referees who used to have banter back. And, you know, was a strange move at first going from Saudi Arabia to Saudi Arabia from England. But after a few months, it was soon forgotten. And, you know, the abuse of social media, for example, you know, seemed to drop. It only seemed to increase when COVID happened because I started rewinding all of my bad performances from many years ago because I had no live matches. So that started again, the abuse.
Do you think you could still do a job in the Premier League now?
Well, not what you see in the size of.
What about in terms of just not in terms of fitness, in terms of the officiating?
No, I think if I'm honest, you think you can do it, but mentally I haven't got that. And that came to me when I went to China. So I left Saudi after 2 years, went to China. And for the first 3-4 months, I was nowhere near to the levels because I dropped so much from the Premier League to Saudi because the intensity of Saudi football, and I wasn't refereeing regular, I seemed to drop fitness levels. I wasn't seeing the decisions the same as I was when I was in the Premier League. So therefore, I'm not sure I could do a job now. And I think the referees now are probably in a better state, psychological, fitness-wise. It would probably take us at least a year now. I'm what, 47? You know, I'm too old now.
Oh, don't say that, mate. And culturally as well, obviously China, Saudi Arabia, very different culturally to England, let's say. Was that a bit of a big shock to you? Or was that all right?
I loved that. I love challenges. I loved, you know, the different cultures. Arab cultures is completely different. And, you know, for example, you would be in Saudi Arabia and they would have a big match. Hilal Nasser is the two big clubs. And it would go on for hours that they would change the match. 2 days before the game, they're going to change the match from a Sunday to a Monday to a Saturday to a Sunday. And this is like a big match. And this never happened in England. The game was kicking off exactly what they stated, unless TV changed. But they would know well in advance. But in Saudi Arabia, they would just make random decisions. And sometimes that would impact on my, you know, appointments as well, because I was bringing foreign referees in. So they were coming in with flights and I was having to rearrange stuff. And, you know, the sports minister for Saudi always wanted foreign referees. This was not my decision. I wanted to develop the local referees, but, you know, the sports minister wanted to enhance Saudi football by bringing the best referees in the world, best players in, which is what they're doing now. So, you know, it was, you know, culturally, it's completely different. And then China is another experience because I couldn't speak to my family till the afternoon because of the time differences. The food was a disaster for me.
Really?
Yeah, because as an athlete, you wanna eat well. So I would be in a hotel before a game, say for example, Guangzhou, and you can't get like normal European food. And you know, I used to meet the referees sometimes for lunch and they would be eating like duck's feet and duck's beak and duck's tongue. And I'm like, how can you eat that before a game? That was because we're European, we want pasta, we want stuff that'll give us the carbs. But in China, I wasn't getting the carbs. I was losing so much weight and you know, I was fatiguing during matches. So it was a complete, you know, different culture shock. But it happened pre-COVID, so the stadiums were full. It was a great atmosphere. I loved my time in China. I would have went back, but COVID ended it.
You know, when you talk about these experiences, they sound incredible, but do you just miss the rigours of the Premier League?
Not now. And I think Tony Pulis probably would say the same. I think once you're out, you see a different world. I think when you're in this bubble, you know, the stresses, the media, the social media, the abuse that you used to take before and after matches. And I remember, like, for example, my second last match was at West Brom. I think, you know, Mike Riley didn't like us because I refereed West Brom twice and fourth official once in my last three games of the Premier League. So, and nothing against West Brom, but I had to stand next to Tony Pulis to get abused because he was one of the most difficult managers. But, you know, I remember him and I refereed a game and I'd made three decisions against West Brom. Three big decisions and all three were correct. And the abuse I took after the match, the following week, I went back to the same stadium. Nobody said a word. Nobody apologised. Nobody said I was right.
When you say abuse, all about it. Though, do you mean from the terraces?
Terraces, the coach and staff, because they think they've been wrong. Till they see it on TV that they haven't been wrong, then reality's different. And people will say VAR stopped a little bit of this because you get the chance to see it again. But I was adamant what I'd seen at my two eyes was correct. So I called the decision and, you know, thank God in that game it was three right decisions.
Are you supportive of VAR generally?
Yes and no.
Go on.
For example, my first time ever at Old Trafford, I was the referee who didn't allow Paulo Mendes's wonder strike from the halfway line. So Roy Carroll scooped it behind the line and people say to me, how did he not see it? Are you crazy? You stand on the halfway line and say 100% it's in.
Yeah.
And, you know, people don't really have the reality, you know. There's no way I can see it.
It's a linesman's role as well, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but when you see a shot coming in from 50 yards, how can an assistant referee run down the touchline and be 100% in line with the goal line to be 100%? You might have a feeling, but you can't go on feeling. You can't turn around and say, I think it's a goal.
Mm.
You've got to be 100% sure it's a goal. And
yeah.
I remember this match. Just a little funny story. And I remember that it was my very first time at Old Trafford. Of course, it's got stresses. And it was 0-0, finished 0-0. Should have been 1-0 at Tottenham with his goal. And as I was coming off, the Sky Steadicam came direct to me. And I thought, oh my God, I've either f***ed up or man of the match. I knew I wasn't man of the match.
So using that guy, as soon as you start talking about Pedro Mendes, you immediately would suggest that you're in favour of VAR, but you did say yes and no.
Yeah, of course. I think it's spoiled the game. I think, you know, the emotion side of it, I think, I believe the World Cup got better because of this semi-automated, however, it caused confusion in the very first opening match with this semi-automated offsides. I think we want to see goals scored and we'll be able to celebrate. And I think maybe in 5 years' time, with VAR evolving even more and more and more, and the level of VAR intervention should be less, and let the referees referee like we used to, and only rely on it when it's needed, then I think it could be in a better shape. But at the moment, every week they're arguing, pundits are arguing, people are arguing every day. Why is that VAR not interfered? Is that a foul? Why is that not given? There's just so many opinions. And at the end of the day, the referees had opinions. I used to go to every fortnight to a meeting with the referees. And we used to argue. So what chance has everybody else got if we're arguing what's a foul, what's not? Because at the end of the day, it's what you say out of your two eyes, how much intention there is, how much, you know, contact there was. And football's a contact sport. And what you sometimes see, you go, why is that not a penalty? And we're like, there's not enough contact. But people will say, well, it's still a foul. And then you've got the argument again. So it's not like cricket and tennis where it's factual.
Yeah, there's a lot of subjective parts of it. But also with VAR as well, I'm a big believer of, like, I think the technology is great, but it's the people that are using it sometimes get things wrong. So would you be up for having, like, let's say an ex-pro in there that understands the game, or do you think that'll be actually hinder the technology?
No, I think it'll be a big thing going forward. I think Howard Webb's openly said from the day he took the job from Mike Riley recently in the last month is that he wants ex-players refereeing. He wants ex-players refereeing, which means with the training as a referee, you'll be able to act as a VAR, because you need that experience in the middle as a referee to be able to act as a VAR. You can't just, you know, train somebody from the street to be a VAR. They've got to know and feel what's going on. And, you know, I believe ex-players is the way forward. I think it will happen more. But from one of my experiences, I remember working with Stevie Baines, who was an ex-professional, and he was fast-tracked in as a referee. And I was an assistant referee for him. And as I was warming up, as we used to warm up before the game, I'm looking for Stevie Baines. I couldn't find him. And I'm thinking, where is he? And there he was in the corner putting balls into the goalkeeper. He still thought he was a player. Forgot that he was a referee. And, you know, they've got to make that transition, you know, what players expect. And it's now different because, for example, a player might not see that as a bad foul, but as referees, under our guidance and criteria that we follow, we'll think it's a bad challenge.
Yeah.
So you've got to find that medium ground of what's expected in football.
Yeah, totally. So you've refereed some of the biggest occasions that there are in football, including the Sidemen match recently.
What a game. One of the best games, most entertaining games I've ever refereed.
Really?
How did it come about that you ref that?
Yeah, me agent. No, I was approached to referee it, and I didn't know. This is how bizarre and funny it was. I'm thinking, who am I refereeing? I didn't know.
Is it a culture you're aware of then? The YouTuber scene?
No. My daughter, who's 11, I'm saying I'm refereeing this game, and my daughter, 11's going, can you get his shirt? Can you get his shirt? Can you get his shirt? I'm like, who are they?
Yeah.
And then when you realize who these people are, I'm like, wow, they're like
the following
huge
they've got.
Stars. Yeah, huge stars. But what I was so impressed with, okay, I'd refereed one or two of them for Soccer Aid, but the level of performance, it was why I'm saying it was one of the most entertaining games. It was 7-6, I think.
Yeah.
And some of the goals were unbelievable. Yeah.
Mini Minta, the lob for the winner was
unbelievable.
Incredible.
So, you know, sometimes you get better games with players who probably aren't professional footballers, and you know, the enjoyment. I remember Speed, for example. I think he was about 500 yards offside.
You should have given it for the culture.
He scored, so I decided, God, for a bit of fun, I'd give him a yellow card for taking his shirt off. Yeah. But he's quite ripped anyways. So as we had a laugh, giving him a yellow card, and then he started chasing us around. But he's so fast. I think I must have ran 10 metres. I'm like...
Should you have sent him off early, do you think? There was a challenge that went in. It was a bit Vinnie Jones in the 88 Cup final.
Leon. I didn't see it.
No VAR, was it?
But you know, when you've got a charity, I think it was for the charities and stuff like that, your referee's slightly different because, you know, it's about enjoyment, one, two, about raising money. As long as, you know, we can officiate and play in the right spirits, you know, it's not like refereeing in a Premier League where it's black and white. I think in charity matches, the most important thing is that they make money and it goes to the right causes.
And get more entertainment, as we saw with the 7-6 scoreline.
Yeah, I loved it. It
was unbelievable. And have you kept in touch with any of them? Any of the players?
No. I did an advert was it Chunksy?
Oh yeah, Chunksy.
Yeah, I did an advert with him recently.
Oh nice. What was that for?
Uber Eats, and that was it. Uber Eats. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Nice. I had to wear the orange coat. The I'll do out for money.
And if given the opportunity, would you referee another Sidemen charity match?
Of course, if my agent lets us. No, of course. I enjoyed it that much. You know, and 26,000 has sold the tickets immediately. You know, I think there was millions of people watching it on YouTube. So, you know, it has its you know, its important points. And, you know, if they ask us again, of course, it's like Soccer Aid every year. They keep asking us to do it because you're a part of the show. And, you know, I'm retired. You know, I'm probably helping the game go and enjoying it as much as we can. You know?
Would you describe yourself as a star now? Would you say that's
not? No. I've never, that's one thing I've always learned. You're never a star in refereeing, and you're just a part of the game. And, you know, what I learned over the years is, and football fans are very, you know, they talk about the laws of the game, they talk about following rules. But at the end of the day, it's like policemen. You've got a set of rules, you've got to manage the rules, you've got to interpreted the rules, and at the end of the day you're just a referee. The players are the stars, but as a top referee you can enhance the game, you can play good advantages, you can keep the game flowing, and that's important for a top referee, to keep the game going, because you know people want to see action, they want to see goals, and that's what sells the Premier League product, because it's one of the most exciting exciting leagues in the world, you know.
So, Mark, we're going to do some quick fire questions with you now, if that's okay, just to get to know you a little bit better.
Oof.
We're going to start with, who did you support when you were growing up?
Not Sunderland. Newcastle, of course.
So, the second biggest club in the North East.
Oh.
Sorry?
Rory's.
I'll tell you a story. No. I'm going to come back at that.
Oh, love it.
I'll tell you why. We can talk about club, who's in the Premier League, who's in. But I remember a story, how big, you know, the clubs are. And Sunderland are a huge club.
for example, when they were in League One, 45,000, 46,000. Amazing. I remember it was when Newcastle win the championship, Sunderland win the Premier League. Sunderland, on a Tuesday night, at home, were playing Chelsea. 42,000. The stadium's 48. So 6,000 short. Newcastle, the following night, played Sheffield Wednesday at home, 52,000. That sums up. Who is the biggest club?
Amazing. Favourite footballer growing up?
Of course. Different because I'm always going to say Newcastle. See, I started off when my father took us, Chris Waddle, Peter Beardsley. Then it went through spells of David Ginola, you know, Les Ferdinand, them, Faustino Asprilla. I remember the day when I was in the Gallagher End when he scored three against Barcelona. Mm. And Gillespie set all three up. But it was, then you had Alan Shearer. And then when you start not being a fan, because I've gone through that cycle of being a football fan, of course I'm still a football fan when I'm a referee. But then I remember as a referee going through my early part of my career, I remember refereeing Luis Suarez playing for Ajax against Slovan Bratislava and he scored four. I was gutted because he took the match ball off us. But you saw talent and you could see his talent. Then I had the chance and lucky enough to referee Messi and Ronaldo, and there's a big argument who's the best player in the world. It's not for me because they're all different. But you had the chance to see world-class players, and I used to pinch myself thinking, man, I'm on the pitch with these players, and you know, something that, you know, I hope that even ex-players or young players who don't make it in the game should try refereeing, because you get the chance to be a part of something amazing, you know.
Have you got a favourite player now?
I haven't really got, you know, I watch football a lot, and you see what's amazing now, you're seeing different superstars rise. Like if you looked at the Moroccan team in the World Cup, you saw some great players coming out of that. And you see, you know, some American players. I had them a few years ago, I was working for a US channel and I got the chance to watch the US team a few times. And you think, wow, they're good players. And then you see them now in Europe, you see some in the Premier League. So everything's evolving so much. It's a young man's game. And, you know, I haven't really got one superstar. But what I love, and, you know, looking back at Newcastle, for example, I love players like Dan Byrne. Why?
What because a player.
He got released by his favourite club, Newcastle. He's gone through the not the long leagues, but, you know, Darlington and the lower leagues, and then rebuilt his career with Brighton. And then he's come to Newcastle. You just see how much it means to a player like that, a bit like Alan Shearer was when he came back to play for his club, home club. And, you know, it must be amazing to do that.
Yeah. And in terms of, like, obviously, your favourite footballers, you know, obviously you went into refereeing. Did you have an iconic favourite referee?
Probably because I was from the North East. George Courtney, he was from the North East, so he refereed international matches. So you had not an icon, but you followed certain styles. So what I used to do is, when I was a young referee, I used to analyse referee styles. So I used to look at them and think, what were they doing that I could do? So I tried to take pieces from everyone. And in the end, you start to mould the way you want to be. And then you listen to coaches, you listen to people. What, you know, for example, probably people used to say, I speak too much on the pitch. But some people say that was a positive. Some people would that say that it was a negative. So you do try and follow certain things and try to mould yourself. But in the end, you're just you and you've just got to be yourself, you know.
Mm. And who would you say is the best referee now?
There's two at the moment. And Anthony Taylor, for example, is going off to the Club World Cup in Morocco, I think it is. And then you've got Michael Oliver. But for me, Michael's from my region in the Northeast, and he's probably more of a natural referee, but he just needs to, you know, probably come out of his shell more. Maybe he's coached that way, where we were allowed to speak to players. It doesn't seem to come across that now. And that's probably now the modern day referees not engaging with the players as much as they used to. Where we used to be able to have some right good banter, and that used to save yellow cards, for example.
Do you think that's in fear of potentially getting repercussions of that? So if they say something, it would get reported in the paper and it would sort of transpire from there.
We've got now, there's so much lip reading. Mm. So, and I remember we had situations when we as a group, some referees got accused of speaking to players inappropriately, and we as a group used to say, well, okay, then if that's what you want, next time you swear at us, or you say something inappropriately, we'll send you off. So you can't have it both ways, you know. But you've got to have a level of a level of banner. I remember refereeing Everton Southampton, and it was Christmas time, and Adam Lallana absolutely volleying us with abuse. And I mean, after the match, volleyed. I should have sent him off. I had the right to send him off, but I tried to use my management skills, and I turned around to him and I said, "You've changed since you played for England." Next day, it's in the newspaper.
No,
really?
Yeah, and you're thinking, how sad is that? I technically should have sent you off.
Mm,
yeah. Well within my rights, but I used my man management skills, and then they used it against us. So you can't have it both ways. And, you know, that probably changed more and more now in the modern game, that, you know, players now would say to you, "You can't speak to me like that." And that's okay then. So you've got to have that fine balance to what players used to do years ago, the banter. There's no such thing as banter anymore.
So that's an example, though. Adam Lallana there is an example of somebody who obviously didn't appreciate that. I would assume that the majority of players would rather have a relationship of discourse where you can have a conversation, sort it out, rather than getting booked or sent off and ending up with a 3-match ban for a silly comment.
100%.
So most players, though, must have been receptive to that.
Yeah, a lot of players were. A lot of players were. And, you know, what I used to find funny, because, you know, how banter used to be. And when you had a foreign player used to sign for a club, you know, you knew what was going to happen next. The foreign player was going to swear at you. And you're like, and then he used to say when he swore at you, because he couldn't speak English, and you look around and all his teammates are laughing because they've been teaching him certain words, not the correct words. So he believes it's right to speak to a referee later. But you have to, not, you know, if you took that personally, knowing what's happening and red card him, you know, when it's a joke and it's a bit of, you've got to then react to that as a referee and you think, oh, okay then. And, but, you know, you've got to be a part of that.
I think Dennis Wise did a lot of that to Gianfranco Zola.
I think he
I think he sort of used to suggest that he would say things that were completely inappropriate to all sorts of people.
Just to get people
but
going.
It's great though, isn't it? I think that's a better way to have a relationship with a ref, I'm sure.
Yeah, and you know, we never went out with them, never had a beer with them. You know, this is fact. You know, they're football players. You had a line of respect. If you've seen them on holiday or you've seen them in different places, of course it would speak. That's the line, you know, but at the end of the day, the referees have a job to do. One week you're the best referee in the world, the next week you're the worst, and players feel the same. They feel like you've been hard done to. But one thing I always learned as a referee is if they trust you, players trust you and coaches trusted you, your decisions were accepted, but they weren't accepted on the terraces. Because if you give a decision against their team, it doesn't matter if it's right or wrong, the abuse you used to take.
And going away from football, what's your biggest interest outside of football? What do you enjoy doing most?
I play a bit of golf. I don't think as good as Tony Pulis was. You think he has more time?
Any good? Would you play off?
It depends if I want to win a competition or not. I'm off 28. No, I just play leisurely. So when I play with my mates, I keep cutting us because I keep winning. So I normally play off about 14.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not bad.
But I always have 2 golf balls in my pocket.
There's no referees there. Sort out.
Have you got a career regret?
Probably people would say not going to the World Cup final in 2018 to Russia. I was on the short list. I would have went 100% because I was the only English representative, and English referees would have 100% went to the finals of Russia. But, you know, it took an opportunity, and I'm a firm believer, and I had this conversation with my family. Should I do it? I would have regretted if I didn't do it than if I had. Do you understand? So I had to do it to regret it, and I never regretted it. But if I'd said no to Saudi Arabia and went to the World Cup, I probably would have regretted that for the rest of my life. So I'm a firm believer, what comes to you, take it and then regret it, then not accepting it and regretting it. So not going to Russia was probably just, because everybody used to say to me, oh, you could referee the final. I probably wouldn't have refereed the final because of politics and everything else. Plus England did well for the first time in a tournament because I used to have to rely on England being knocked out of the tournament. So when England was so bad, I'm like, cha-ching, I've got a chance. I've got a chance. You know, I remember
recently. That must have been happening a lot.
For example, in France, you know, I knew I had the chance of the final. In England, we're playing Iceland. So we're in this bar and it was full of England fans. And I'm the only English fan jumping up and down at the end of the game. Everybody's looking at us going, what the f*** are you doing? And I'm like, oh,
Because they didn't know, you know.
Yeah, but of course. I knew. Yeah, and on the flip side of like regrets and stuff, what's your proudest moment so far?
Probably walking out of the Champions League final, to have my family in the stadium, to walk out. And, you know, you push yourself, you sacrifice a lot. Your family sacrifice a lot because you're away a lot. You're training a lot. Sometimes, for example, my family, when I used to come back from a match on a Saturday, they would disappear because they knew if I had a bad match, I was in a foul mood. So they knew, so I'm giving them something back to enjoy in Milan, which was the Champions League final in 2016. And I remember the only thing I remember, because I can't even remember much in the match, but I remember before the game, and we're in a tunnel and there was Coque on one side for Madrid and then you've got Ramos for Real. And they're both screaming at us before the game, come on, we want to get out. And I'm like, well, I can't do anything. I'm waiting for them to tell us to walk out. It was, I think it was Alicia Keys was singing. And they were telling us to go and stop her. And I'm like, I can't physically go and stop
something
on this game.
Oh,
yeah, just stop.
Yeah. Yeah. Imagine that, Mark Hamburg running down. Sorry, Alicia, just give us a moment.
Packing in, no one cares about New York.
Yeah, nobody cares. So, eventually we got the go-ahead to go out and I'd just lost it. And I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do? And been a little bit of a panic moment. And there's the ball on the plinth. And I'm thinking to myself, don't drop the ball. And when I got the ball off the plinth, I was like, I didn't want to drop it.
That's amazing. And who do you think has been the most influential person in your career?
Probably my family. It is a collective, because without your family and the sacrifices you used to put, I wouldn't have been the person I was. You know, they used to go through emotions of, you know, and I suppose that'll be the same for a player and a coach. You win, you're happy, you lose. But in refereeing, you never win because even if it's a draw, one team still complains about decisions. And I think when I first started, I remember this. When we first started, we only had newspapers and I used to love the Sun newspaper because he used to mark you. And I didn't want a seven. I hated sevens. I loved sixes because I used to turn the paper upside down so I had a nine. but then everything changed after that. You had social media. And the problem with that is it becomes permanent and then your family start reading it and the abuse you used to take from people was so much that, you know, your family get infected. But, you know, over the years you try and teach them not to read it, you know, and be strong, and they got the rewards because, you know, they got the chance to go to the FA Cup final, Champions League final, Euro final. So they've had the chance to see some of the most amazing games in the world. And they've had the chance to watch Newcastle, of course.
Has anyone ever given you a piece of advice that has really resonated with you that you've held on to?
Yeah. When I started off refereeing, just be yourself. Don't be anybody else. Be yourself. And I grew up in not a difficult life, but, you know, not a privileged life. So you've come from council estate, parents didn't have much money, and my father died early. And so you had all these things to deal with, and it just made you stronger. And, you know, the advice, you know, be yourself. I didn't want to be somebody. So when I used to speak to players used to have that relationship because I used to speak to the best player in the world, the same as a grassroots player. I didn't have any airs and graces. You know, you get what you get with me. And players liked that. They could, you know, I didn't muddy cuddle millionaire players. I just treat them exactly the same. And, you know, they liked it. And, you know, I could build that relationship up. So it was a good bit of advice for me.
So, Mark, obviously you've reffed some of the biggest occasions that there are in the sport. Is there an occasion, is there a match that really sticks with you for just being a classic football occasion?
Yeah. And not because of the high, there was big stakes on it. It was Spurs-Chelsea.
Was that the one with the...
What, the two-all?
The battle of the bridge.
Stamford Bridge? Yeah,
Battle of the Bridge.
Eden Hazard?
Yeah.
No way.
Gosh, of course.
So if you really go into the understanding of the game, you know, as a referee, you've got to understand the importance. And the importance is Leicester City have the chance to win the title. And it was quite a unique moment in the Premier League because no other team had ever changed the dominance of the big sides, for example. And Leicester won the verge. And they knew that Tottenham had to get a result against, sorry, was it Stamford Bridge?
Yeah, it was Stamford Bridge.
And
I knew the importance of this match. And what you can read in the media what's going on. The players from Chelsea, who had had a bad season for their standards, were playing an enemy.
Yeah, totally.
So therefore, I knew the importance, the banter on between the players. All Chelsea cared about was stopping Tottenham winning the title. And it started from the first whistle. They were just kicking lumps. Yeah. And people say to me, why did you do, why did he not apply the laws of the game? Why did he not do this? Why did he not do that? With VAR, with VAR, we might not have finished the match.
Yeah.
But the problem was, you're in this spectacle, you're in this whole environment. And what fans don't understand is they want the letter of the law literally applied, but you know the importance of the match and how difficult the match is going to be. And when you saw what went on and how, for example, Tottenham, the players, when Chelsea equalised 2-2 and they'd realised that the title was slipping away, you could just see the discipline drop. Yeah.
They lost
because they'd lost it. The young players that weren't in this situation before, they didn't know how to react to it. And as a referee, I could go in and solve it by giving red cards, but it could have the other effect. So I'm trying to work out what's the best way to manage till the end of this match. And probably one of the regrets in that match was probably not sending off Eric Dier.
Yeah.
But what I saw, and I didn't register it because there was that much going on around, I didn't register that it was Eric Dier. And I played an advantage because Chelsea had the chance to go on and score. But hindsight would have been that was the one I could have just went, that's enough's enough, red card, and possibly had one red card at the end of the game. But there was criticism on my performance by the purist. But actually, as a sporting event around the world, that would have been watched as one of the most enthralling.
It's an iconic game. And do you know what? You're so right about the sort of magnificence of that occasion, because I'm a Chelsea fan. And the week before, I think the weekend before, it was St. George's Day. I remember going down to Bournemouth. We played at Bournemouth. And I've never been in an away end like this before. But we weren't focused at all on that game.
Yeah.
All we were singing is, make sure that you beat Tottenham next week. That's all we were singing. For 90 minutes, all we care about is not today. It's about the fixture that's coming in 3 or 4 days' time.
Yeah, because all you wanted to do was stop Tottenham winning the title.
Totally. I remember, because we played Leicester last day of the season. I remember on the build-up, once Chelsea's season was a write-off, I remember saying to my mate, Chelsea have two things to do this season. We need to beat Tottenham and lose to Leicester. That's all we need to
do. Is that what you do as a fan? Yeah. I want to win the Mall League.
Not that year. Certainly not. But gosh, that must have been such, because it went really bad post the full-time whistle, didn't it?
Yeah.
Because he didn't got pushed over. Costa. Yeah. Danny Costa. Rose crying in the dressing room.
Did the Costa eye gouge as well? Was that that
game? That was Costa's eye gouge. That was Costa. Normally it's the other way around. And for him not to react, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Does it go on after the, you know, after the game then? So you've blown the full-time whistle.
Yeah.
Stamford Bridge erupts. Tottenham fans are livid. Mm-hmm. And then that wasn't the end. Usually that would be the end of it, wouldn't it?
Because the players had lost discipline. Everybody had lost the discipline because Chelsea had stopped Tottenham, basically. Leicester won the title. So their dream, and you've got to understand football players, it was their dream to win the title. Yeah. And all of a sudden, from 2-0 half-time, they've drawn the game 2-2.
Yeah.
And now the chance to make Leicester go on and win the title mentally was a challenge.
Yeah.
You know, so Tottenham had the best chance ever to win the title, and they've lost the moment. So not that I defend players, but I can understand players' frustration. And as we're going down the tunnel, because it's also a very tight tunnel at Chelsea, everybody's trying to squeeze into one area. Probably there was some pushing, shoving, probably more than people thought it was that what you see, because everybody's just trying to get down the tunnel. And then I think poor Gus Hiddink was on the floor. Yeah. And then, you know, I think he...
Danny Rose was in tears.
Was he? Yeah.
Does it continue? Does your role as a ref? So do you then go into your referee quarters?
Yeah.
Did anyone come and see you? Is there like a post-mortem of the occasion?
Post-mortem?
An examination. Is there an examination of the occasion?
Like, hold on, I haven't died. For example, in the Premier League, we don't have a referee observer. So the referee observer doesn't come. There's no ex-referee comes to your dressing room. It's an ex-player. So he'll come in and give you from a player's perspective, a coach's perspective, a team's perspective. And you get marked accordingly. I wasn't bothered about me mark. You know, it was more that I came out of a game without as least controversy as possible, because people say to me, the referee is the one that you don't see. But there's times where even if you don't give decisions, you get criticized because people said I should have had four red cards. But if I'd give four red cards, I would have been killed for damaging the game. So it's a very fine balance. So, you know, I remember that night going back to the hotel, I couldn't sleep. But the next morning was brutal because the match reports I'd had a complete was just unreal.
Mm. You know, when you're in a game like that, can you appreciate it? Because at the epicenter of who you are, you're a football fan. You know, you're on the Gallagher end as a kid and that. Are you appreciating what's going on? Like when Eden Hazard that day in front of the Tottenham fans in the Shed End scored one of the best goals I've ever seen with my own eyes. Mm-hmm. Are you feeling that as a ref? Like when that ball hits the back of the net, do you have a moment and go, wow, or are you so focused on
the referee? Sometimes when you see screamers, you go, brilliant. Yeah. And sometimes you go past the player,
start clapping.
But then the player sometimes come back to you. Sometimes, you know, the feeling's mutual. When something happens in a game and a player does something brilliant, wow. I'll go, wow, what a great goal. But when you play good advantage, players will come past you and say, great advantage, especially when they've scored. So, you know, players aren't as bad as people make out to be. You know, if they do something good, why shouldn't the referee say, wow, I remember some great goals.
What was the best one you've seen?
I've seen quite a few. I'm trying to think of one. You know, I remember Matty Taylor scoring a screamer for Portsmouth.
Oh, for Portsmouth. Yeah. That was on the volley?
Yeah. Screamer. And you think...
That was unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Wow. And I remember like Jakiri playing in the Euro when he scored against, Poland?
Or was it Switzerland?
Poland, Switzerland. And he scored a screamer. And you're thinking... And he used to say... I remember Jakiri saying to me, because he played for Stoke and he always scored screamers. And I think he scored a screamer for Stoke and I was reffing. And he came past us that game and he says to me, he says, Mark, you're my lucky ref. I says, why? He says, every time I score screamers, you're the ref.
That's close. And then what's the toughest game you've ever refereed in Premier League?
Yeah, there's also tough mental games, you know. Everything had importance. You know, I remember in my very first season going to Crystal Palace. And you say, Charlton, Crystal Palace. And you say, why Charlton? The stresses that are in that game for Crystal Palace, because there was three teams vying to go down. It was Fulham, Palace, and West Brom. And I remember Brian Robson was a coach. And all afternoon, you're on the pitch and you're hearing different sounds from the stadium. You're hearing cheers. You're hearing, come on, for the players to hurry up. And all of this, you know, transpires on the field of play. So you're trying to referee games knowing that the scores are important. So you've got to react to that. So the stresses, and I remember my first year thinking, wow, this is like unique. And then I remember doing, like when Liverpool could have won the title the first time under Brendan Rodgers. And I remember them, I was a referee when they beat Man City 3-2.
Yeah.
And I remember Gerrard crying, telling us to finish the match.
Really?
Because it meant so much to them. The following week he slipped and give Demba Ba the chance. And then I refereed them at Palace.
Yeah, the 3-0.
And I remember the players, this is how crazy it was. They were winning 3-0 Liverpool and the players are telling me to hurry the goalkeeper from Crystal Palace. I've never heard this before.
Because when you're winning 3-0.
When you're winning 3-0. But they realised they needed it. I think it was a 9-goal swing. Mm. So they're trying to score more goals. And I'm thinking, man, this is crazy. And then it went 3-1, 3-2, 3-3. Mm. And it could have been 4-3 to Palace.
Mm.
And a fair play to Brendan Rodgers, you know, after that. And I think he knew his title was over, but he waited for us outside my dressing room door. He had absolutely no complaints. And he, you know what? Coaches used to make excuses. Certain coaches didn't, and he was one of the gentlemen.
Was there a particular ground that you didn't like refereeing in?
Yeah. There's two. One, Norwich. And it was because the A14 was brutal.
So it wasn't Delia Smith or anything like that.
I was thinking of all the hostile places you must have
been. No, because right. Because you couldn't get a flight there unless you went via Amsterdam, and the Premier League wouldn't give you that privilege.
Amsterdam.
Yeah, Newcastle, Amsterdam, Norwich. I was like, ding dong. But what you don't understand is if you're driving from the north, if anybody lives in the north of England, and you're driving to Norwich, the first 3 hours is okay. But the last hour is brutal because it's single road.
Windy road, yeah.
And when you're on a single road and you're driving, it's the other side that you're worrying about. So you want to get to Norwich. And then the worst thing, especially on a night match, the first hour of that journey, is brutal because it's pitch black. There's tractors on the road and all sorts. And you're like, want to get home. So that was never one of my most memorable stadiums. And probably the other one was Palace. And I'll tell you a little story about Palace, and they'll probably hear this still. And it's one of the most bizarre statistic that I have. And it's just unique. I remember refereeing Palace in the playoffs against Brighton. They win 1-4. They get a chance. Terrible not an game. Issue. So Mark Klamberg isn't the problem, you know. And then the minute they get into the Premier League, nothing went right. I probably compounded one or two situations, made mistakes, 100%. But there's other times, and I remember, I think they'd lost 6 Premier League games when I was reffing. Or they hadn't won in 6. And I remember they were playing Aston Villa. Aston Villa were plumb bottom just after New Year. Plumb bottom. And I'm thinking, this is the moment. They must win. You know, statistics tell you that Crystal Palace were a decent side. Villa were bottom. Hennessy threw one in. They got beat 1-0. I'm thinking, this is my life. This goes to 7. And I still get the blame. And I think it went to 12 or 30. And then the cup, they never won a game in the Premier League when I was ref.
Wow.
And then we went to the cup final and I didn't play an advantage in the opening minutes, probably just because Wembley, it's your, you know, FA Cup final. It's like a player, you want to get on the ball. I wanted to blow me whistle. And I probably should have played. Sure, I should have played an advantage. You don't know what's going to happen. They scored, Connor Wickham scored, but everybody had stopped. Yeah. Everybody makes an excuse for it. But it was one of them where everything seemed to go wrong for Palace. But I remember the cup final, for example. I've never had this unique statistic. I go up one side of Man United to collect my medal. I'm getting booed. As I come back down, I'm getting booed off Palace. I didn't want to get my medal.
I'll tell you what, as a Brighton fan, that makes me really happy. So hopefully we can get you back into the Premier League, get some more Palace games under your belt. And then talking of clubs, what about players? Was there any players that you had run-ins with, or ones you thought, I've got him today and I don't want to ref him?
I think one of the most I think some referees say the same thing, so I'm not unique when I say this. Probably the player that I didn't get on with, he didn't get on with me and I didn't get on with him, was Craig Bellamy. And some of it's my fault, but what I loved, and I wish, and I keep saying this, to Newcastle United, they should have kept him. Just signed him on a 20-year deal. Because if he stayed at Newcastle, I wouldn't have had the chance to referee him. So therefore, I wouldn't have crossed paths.
Yeah.
But the moment he left Newcastle, I started refereeing him, and he played for Man City. And it was my fault. It was my own fault, because he abused us in the first half. I gave him a yellow card. And going back to how things change. I remember half time to a coach and staff of Man City saying, how do you put up with this guy? He's constantly abusing us. Is this what he like in the training ground? That ended up in the newspapers. So that's what happened in football. Yeah. So sometimes you're best off not speaking.
Yeah.
And then I ended up sending him off. And when you watch it was a penalty and I quotient him for diving. And he wouldn't forgive us. And he was right. Mm. I was wrong. You know, and I probably got sucked into his way of, you know, he was not manipulative, but he was hard work and he was in your face. He was in your ear. He was, you know, not controlling, but he was difficult. And I ended up spending more time with him, fighting with him, than I should have. I should have just left him.
Would you admit that to him though? Like, would you say, look, last game, I made a mistake, you know, or would you try and explain your decisions to him to try and help maybe?
Yeah, he did. He grabbed me balls in the tunnel at Man City.
No.
It was a laugh. It's a joke, of course.
Oh, okay.
It was just a banner.
Just a banner, Just grab your balls as a banner. Yeah, fair.
But, you know, probably me and him, I've made many mistakes to players, but they've easily recovered from it. Mm-hmm. They move on from it. You know, Mark, you've made a mistake. I remember Vincent Kompany, for example. I'd made a mistake in the first half and I'm coming out of the second half and I'm gutted. I'm really gutted that I've made a mistake. And Vincent Kompany put his arm around, he says, Mark, we'll all make mistakes, don't worry.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, different levels, you know, different people, different human beings.
Yeah. And any other players spring to mind? Like, what about John Terry? Any run-ins there?
I like John Terry. Yeah, I mean, John was a gentleman. Talking what I said about advantages, if he did something good, he would come past you and say, great job, you know. Mm. So he had that side of him. I never had any big run-ins, but I sent him off. And I sent him off later on in his career. He was playing, it was West Brom Chelsea. And when I sent him off, he was sent off for last man or denial. Yeah. And as I'm coming back into my dressing room at West Brom, there he was sitting on my sofa. trying to like, you know, justifies, you know, shouldn't have been sent off, but everybody knew he had to be sent off. So but he never held it against you. He would always still be the gentleman he was. So he wasn't a problem. I tell you what used to happen as well was in the Man United days, and it was certainly a coaching technique from Sir Alex Ferguson, was when he refereed United, they would just keep coming at you one by one to try and get the next decision, push you. And, you know, Rio Ferdinand was a master of it. He would come in, then Gary Neville would come in, then Nicky Butt would come in, Roy Keane would come in. They would just systematically come at you. Really? Never the one same player.
Yeah.
It was just one after another, and they were just influencing the next decision.
It's like the tactical foul, isn't it? It's the sort of tactical approach to the
But when you get experience, when you're a young referee, you're thinking, how can I deal with this?
Mm.
And then when you get a bit more experience, you're just laughing. Yeah, tell your coach, I know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then talking to coaches, was there any managers that you sort of...
No. I like Tony Pulis.
Yeah.
There's some good... I suppose when they're coaching, that 90 minutes, that can be a disaster. You know, Arsene Wenger was a prime example of that. When Arsenal were winning and they were invincible, Arsene Wenger was one of the most gentlemen I've ever come across. Always acknowledged, always appreciated my style of refereeing, because I knew how Arsenal would play, and I knew teams would want to foul Arsenal because they want to stop them because they're quick. But I used to try and find little advantages so to open the other team up, and they knew I could do it. So they scored some goals because I could see the next movement and they could score. So he liked my style of refereeing, but near the end, he got bitter, you know, over, you know, he didn't have that control and dominance that he used to have. And therefore he gets frustrated. And then I used to get his frustration, even though most of it wasn't my fault. So, but that was just the 90 minutes. Outside of it, completely different. Tony Pulis was another example. You know, he's passionate. You know, when he was at Stoke, for example, mamma mia, you know, one of the most difficult stadiums to referee because it's so cold, even in the summer. But in the way Tony Pulis used to play his teams, you know, it was always high balls, long balls into the box. And, you know, and he would always attack you for 90 minutes, but afterwards, complete gentleman. So you saw that in football, the emotions of it, because at the end of the day, they want to win football matches, and you want to do your best you can without being controversial and try and get as many calls right.
You know what I thought was interesting there, Mark? You said that there was a moment when you were coming out for a second half and Vincent Kompany put his arm around you because you were agonising over a decision that you'd previously made in the first half.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with decisions like that? Because obviously you can't let it impact what you do in the second half. You can't let it be an equaliser or anything like that.
No.
How do you try and put it out of your mind?
Yeah, two wrongs don't make a right.
Yeah.
However, you've got to understand football. You've got to understand everybody wants balance. Everybody wants fairness. So what do you do to one team? You're fair to the other team. I think that's what most people accept. And when you've made a mistake, when you're a young referee, it's harder to deal with. Because you're frustrated and you're like, I've made a mistake. And what I used to do, psychological, and we used to have a psychologist to help you, I used to just concentrate on the first half of the game. I never used to think about the second half. I used to put everything into the first half, get to half time, analyze in my head, I haven't made a mistake. And that used to make us feel like Superman going out to the second half thinking, I've not made a mistake in the first half. I'm going to make sure that I don't make a mistake. And the worst thing is for a referee is the last few minutes, because you can have the best game, but in 89 minutes, you make one decision.
Call, yeah.
And sometimes as a ref, you think, don't go in the penalty area, the ball, don't go in the penalty area, don't go in the penalty area, because that was always your key moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
Penalty
yeah.
or no penalty. When it was in midfield, you're thinking, oh, good.
And you talk about having a psychologist and, you know, that sort of mental side of the game. Did you ever struggle with, you know, outside, let's say there was a bad decision, would you ever struggle with that? And how was your coping mechanisms? Did you have something you'd go to? To help
with
that?
Not for a podcast, what I used to do. Because we're in the right environment. It's difficult. I had a good family. So, for example, they would just disappear. When I got home, they would disappear. Mm. They knew by my voice. I would be traveling home. She didn't have to read the news or the social media, the Twitter.
Mm.
She knew by my voice that I was frustrated with myself. Most of the time I was, because I was a perfectionist. I wanted to be perfect. And unfortunately, in refereeing and in football, you can't be perfect. Mm. Players aren't perfect. Referees aren't perfect. Coaches aren't perfect. Nobody is perfect. But you want perfection.
Mm.
And, you know, I used to really be in a bad mood. If the game was a Saturday, I was really bad mood Sunday. I didn't want to do anything. I wouldn't go out. And then on a Monday, you started re-evaluating, because then you got another match on a Monday night. for the weekend again, so you had to refocus. So you just had this revolving circle of trying to deal with the emotions. And I suppose the hardest bit is when, and it's probably players might say the same, is sometimes as refs, you were making one or two mistakes or one or two decisions that were controversial. And it seemed to happen one after the other. And you're like, just give me one quiet match. And you're thinking, this is it. And then something else happens. And you're like, how is this? It feels like the world's against you. And then there's other times you're probably putting more into the game. You're probably running faster. You're probably running more. And he's still something's happening. And then other times you're just relaxing and then nothing happens. And you're like, how is this happening?
Do you think that closure would have helped in terms of maybe if you had to face the press, maybe if you had to explain a decision, it would allow that to be over?
Yeah. With closure for VAR is a good one, because when I was in China, I used to use VAR, same in Saudi. So what was good, especially to clear your mind, you've made a call and you're thinking, oh God, I want to say that at the end of the game. But you don't need to, because if VAR is saying you go to the screen, you've got the second chance to say it, which is a great thing, because then it means I can move on.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Even if you've made a mistake, at least you can correct it.
Do you think refs should have to explain decisions? Do you think there should be a bit of press time for refs?
Yeah, I think we'll see in the next 6 months that, or even in the next month, that referees will explain their decisions over VAR. I think there'll be a microphone soon. Mm. And I think fans in the stadium, TV companies will hear the audio, because it's transparency. Why should you not hear what's going on with VAR? So I don't agree with a post-match. I'm not interested in referees speaking after the game. I don't think it has its much. Mm. You know, coaches now and the players now are just, they're like recording.
Mm.
You know, they're saying the same thing.
Yeah.
It's just another day. So do we want referees to really do that? I don't think it adds any value. But I think what will add value is what we hear the referees mic'd up, and also the VARs mic'd up, so we can hear the conversations.
Do you think that's a good idea though? Because I remember they tried this once, didn't they? I think it was David Ellery in a Millwall versus Arsenal game. I know this is decades ago. This is sort of the Tony Adams, Paul Merson era.
Yeah.
But it wasn't really transmittable, what we were hearing.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that a worry?
In them days it was, but I think the game's changed so much now. I think, you know, the language is completely, you know, I'm not saying it's completely removed, but it's changing all the time. The society's changing so much. So what you hear on the field isn't as bad as it used to be. But even when what you can do, and that was done deliberately because it was for the TV companies, when you've got VAR, you can't hear what the players say. It's only what the conversation.
Yeah.
If I speak, when we used to listen to audios from the referees, we couldn't hardly hear the players, even if they were 5 meters away because of the way the system was built. But certainly with technology, with a VAR, if you're, for example, you're sitting at home or you're in the stadium and you're thinking, well, why is the VAR interfered there? And if you could hear that conversation, I think people would accept it more and probably embrace the technology more, because sometimes the technology or the use of the technology is cold and you're not really understanding the procedure, what's gone on, why the VAR didn't interfere here. And I think if I had them dialogues, I think it would be beneficial.
And yeah, what relationship did you have with other referees? Is it like a brotherhood type kind of thing? Do you all stick together in the tough and good times?
We used to have Christmas parties.
Did you? What was the best Christmas party you
had? Phil Durkin doing his moves.
They were f***ing boring as f***.
You're all comparing schools. You're like, I got a 7 this week. I got a 6.
We all went with black outfits. It was strange. What I found, referees are very strange. I'm probably strange. I think we're a strange bunch. And you know, it's interesting when you leave, it's even more strange. Nobody contacts you. Every referee used to say that. A lot of referees used to leave the group as a Premier League referee, and you never hear from people again. You know, it's just seems to be the life it is. You know, there's a lot of rivalry in the group because everybody wants the big games. Some referees didn't want the big games because they were scared. But, you know, in general, most of the referees wanted big games. And then with that, you had the rivalry when you went into UEFA matches because everybody wanted to be, you know, doing the top games abroad. So
who was your rival? Do you have like an arch nemesis in the referee?
No, because I used to work with Howard Webb a lot. I worked with him in the Euro in 2012 in Poland in Ukraine. I was his additional behind the goal and supported him. So I didn't have that. I didn't want rivalry. I just wanted to help people. I wanted people to help me. You know, I don't see anybody as my rival, I'll try my best. If my best isn't good enough and somebody's better than me, that's life. But I'll try and be the best I can. And then when Howard retired, I had the rivalry with Martin Atkinson, and you know, he went to the Euro, I went to the Euro. He did the Europa League final. I did the following year, I did the Champions League final. So it wasn't what I liked about the rivalry. Some people used to see it as a negative, but actually over the last 10, 12 years, even though people think English refereeing's in a bad state, you know, we've done an awful lot. We've refereed two Champions League finals, Nations League final with Anthony Taylor, under 17s, under 20s, Olympic Games final, Euro final, Europa League final, Euro final, World Cup. So actually English referees have done every final. Yeah. So credit to English referees. So everybody thinks it's a negative, but it's a positive also.
Do you think that is because the Premier League is so well coveted? Do you think just by default, and no disrespect, but do you think it's by default that the referees get better opportunities than, let's say, other countries, or do you think it is the referees?
I think it works in cycles because, for example, Howard Webb was lucky in 2010 because English clubs weren't so dominant. The national team wasn't so dominant.
Right.
Then we had a period where, for example, I think, was it 2008, 9 English teams dominated Champions League? Then you had an era where they didn't, and they went through a cycle. Spanish, Italy teams became, so their referees couldn't do finals.
Right.
And then all of a sudden we had a chance. And then I had a very lucky point because in 2016, Man City played Real Madrid in the semi-final. If Man City win,
you're not doing it.
I can't do the final. Yeah. So I was lucky in that period that the Spanish teams were strong.
Yeah.
Mm. Now the English referees haven't got so many opportunities because English teams will be strong in Champions League. So it cycles.
Do you think that there's a quality that's needed to be a good referee? A sort of arrogance quality?
I wouldn't say arrogance, confidence. But people say too much confidence can mean arrogance. People used to say that about me.
Maybe Graham Pohl, Mike Dean.
But I don't think it's arrogance. Players never used to call us arrogant, but the fans used to. Maybe the way I acted, maybe the way I ran, maybe the way I looked. All of this, people are prejudging you all the time. That's just life now. Whatever you do in life, people are prejudging. Everybody's got an opinion. But at the end of the day, there is a fine line between arrogance and confidence. I was probably shy, but probably I looked arrogant. But I wanted to be confident and I wasn't all the time. You know, you want to show the players that you're confident, because if you show your confidence, players used to leave you alone. So you had to make sure that you didn't look arrogant. And I know that's very hard to explain, but you know, there is a fine line. But for me, the most important thing as a ref is, you know, man management skills. I remember doing a game when I was in grassroots and I sent a player off and he was going to wait for us to attack us after the match. And it was the only time I never got a match fee after the game, because I ran straight to my car after the final whistle. Yeah. And that's wrong.
Yeah.
But it was survival. Mm. Not to get me match fee, just to get out of the area, because I didn't want to be abused. I didn't want to be attacked. I remember going out on nights out with my friends and there was players in the bar and players in the toilet and saying, ah, you're a shit referee. And, you know, I hope you're not refereeing me on Sunday and stuff like that. So you've got all of this. But what it does, it creates you. Man management skills, survival skills. Yeah. So when you go on the field, as a ref, especially in your early part, it's about survival. And the ones that are the most successful are the ones that have the man management.
And I know this is a bit out of what we've just been talking about, but of course, Mike Dean always pops up as being a bit of a cult hero now. I know, obviously, like, you will see him online, his videos come out when he's like a big Tranmere fan, obviously. Would you consider him a celebrity? And then secondly, would you say that yourself, out of you two, who's the biggest celeb?
I don't even know what a celeb is.
It's you.
No, I think what he's done, he's had the same journey as me, I think from a sausage factory to become a referee. Mm. So he hasn't really come from a normal industry or a normal industry for refereeing, for example, policemen, school teachers, that type of environment. What I liked about Mike Dean was his personality. I like referees with personality, and he had such a personality. He was always laughing and joking when we used to meet up every 2 weeks. He wasn't the funniest guy, because me and Phil Dow was the joker. We used to hide things, mess about. So we had that, but Mike Dean was always sharp, funny, popular within the group. good referee top matches. So he was well respected. And, you know, I think I was half expecting him this year to probably appear on Strictly Come Dancing or
I'm a celebrity.
A celebrity in the jungle or whatever, you know. But he stayed on as a VAR, so probably limited his options. And now probably next year people will forget who Mike Dean is. So, but over me and him, probably him. All I wanted to do was do the best I could as a ref. And I tried to do that. Whatever happened outside of it, I just want to look after my family.
So you've spoken to us about your agent. You've already done a Sidemen charity game. Is there going to be a hat trick? Are we going to see you waltzing on Strictly or maybe in a jungle?
I think my agent would want the commission from it. That, you know, if I had the opportunity, I'm sure that he would be pushing that to me. I'm not sure my wife would let us. I think she's seen us dancing and I am the worst dancer in the world.
What about I'm a celeb then? Like, would you go in the jungle and eat some testicles? Animal testicles? Can well, I say
actually,
that?
I don't know. The two guys, Ant and Deck, I'll probably have a field day with because I'm probably the only person that understands them. That's good. But no, I think there's no way I could eat that.
No.
I'd probably want to be voted out. Plus, the problem I've got is because I'm probably one of the most hated probably men would be in there.
You'd get
because
voted
I'm the referee. They'll probably vote us just to upset us. So not that I really fancy that. But I always wanted to do the voiceover for Big Brother, like Day 45 in the Big Brother.
Imagine that.
That's quality. Amazing. 2016, take you back there. Good year for you.
Yeah.
You were, I don't think this is extreme to say, you were the best referee in the world then.
Yeah, it was hard. It wasn't 2016, it started before that, probably 13, 14. And I'll tell you a quick story. What happened was, I remember you set goals at the start of the season and that was 15, it might have been 15. And we set goals. And one of my goals was to referee a semi-final of a Champions League. You don't set your goals to, I'm going to referee the World Cup final and Champions League final, because sometimes things aren't in your control. But my plan was to do a semi-final. And I was appointed the game. I knew I was going to get the game. And how we used to know, we didn't have the appointment, but we used to get the flights. So we used to open the flights. And when I'm flying to Munich, it didn't take a genius to work out, I'm going to referee Bayern Munich. So I'm refereeing Bayern Munich, Barcelona. So this is second leg. And to do a second leg, it's privileged, because the second leg is one of the most important. So I watched the first leg and I watched it 6 times. I'm analysing it. I want to make sure that I'm ready for the game because it's one of my most important games in my life. And I watched the game. I turns up at the game, turns up the match day before. Colina's me observing. I'm like, oh, no way. Pierluigi Colina, my boss is me observing me match. So the next day over lunch, he said, I want to speak to you. So he opened his laptop. He said, have you watched the match the night before, the game before? I said, 100% I have. I've analysed it 6 times. He said, have you really? I said, yeah. He says, did he say anything in the game? I said, no. He said, are you sure? No. He showed us 6 clips of players' tactics. And all it was Thiago from Bayern Munich, who was at Liverpool now, the smallest player, just blocking Piqué from Barcelona, who was the tallest player. And if you remember the Barcelona team at that era, they were all small players.
Yeah.
So they were just creating Muller, Lewandowski spaces to score, you know?
Mm.
And I'm thinking, wow, this is incredible level of detail. And that was the moment. And I just solved it on the pitch. I gave a free kick after 30 minutes. And I said to Thiago, if you keep doing that, my friend, I'll punish you with a free kick. Nobody even knew in the stadium, but the players knew, the coaches knew, and the players after that, I could have given 6 penalties and the players believed us because they realized I was at their level. They knew what out they were doing. And that was where Pierluigi Colina helped us. He analysed the game different to anybody else. And he learned me to do that. So I was going into players' heads before they actually did it. And the players were like, how do you know that? Because I know you're going to do it. And when you got into that level of detail, players were just so scared and realised you're actually one of the top referees because they knew our tactics. Normally referees used to blow the whistle, penalty, and react. Top referees don't react. They're actually
proactive.
You see it before. So all of these details helped me to reach 2016. And I was then best prepared for all of the finals. I made mistakes. I made a mistake in the FA Cup final by not playing an advantage to Palace. I probably made mistakes in the Champions League final. Somebody will tell us.
I probably made finals mistakes in the Euro final. We're human beings. I didn't have VAR then. But what I did, and people don't appreciate, that for them three finals, the only thing I really wanted to do, and it's sad, is to blow the final whistle. Because then you wanted to get off that pitch without any controversy. Starting the match is nervous because you have 90 minutes in front of you and you just don't want to be remembered for any mistakes.
Yeah. And talking of those three big cup finals, what's the process of finding out that you're going to be refereeing one of these finals? Do they send you a letter? Do they send you an email? Like, how does the process behind it work?
So the FA Cup final, somebody from the referee committee of the Football Association in London contacted you by mobile saying that you're going to referee the FA Cup final. The Champions League one was a bit strange, more stranger because I'm travelling down the M1 to go to the meeting to the referees. It's St George's Park. And Pierluigi Colina. My mobile goes and it's Pierluigi. And at that point, I'm just about to pass an exit for the motorway. So I quickly pull off the exit because I didn't want to speak on when I'm driving. And I pulls over and I'm thinking to myself, no, Pierluigi's ringing us. He's going to
You've done something wrong, yeah.
He always, when he rings us, I've done something wrong. So I'm thinking, what have I done? I'm racking my brains. And then I answer the phone call and he said, how's things? I said, very good. He says, congratulations, finally on the FA Cup final. I said, appreciate it. Thank you very much. He said, would you like to go to Milan? And I knew Milan was the Champions League final. And I said, and why I said what I said was that all of the media around the world was saying Jonas Eriksson from Sweden would referee the final because Jonas was very experienced, great friend of mine. He would be refereeing the final. So my reaction to Pierluigi Colina was, great, I would love to be fourth official. And he said, who said you're going to be fourth official? I said, sorry. He said, who said you're going to be fourth official? I said, what do you mean? He said, you're going to be refereeing. I went, in my typical Geordie accent, don't be stupid. And he didn't understand it because he's Italian. And I said, sorry, I shouldn't be doing the game. And he went, do you not want the match? And I said, of course I want the match. So we ended the phone call and I rings my wife. And I said, Claire, says, we're going to Milan. She went, what do you mean? I'm going to referee the Champions League fan. She went, you know what? The first word she said, can I buy a new handbag?
No way.
Yeah. She didn't care about me refereeing the match. She just wanted a new handbag. So I thought, well, that was a nice phone call. So I started ringing my colleagues because I had a team, steady team. And Jake Collin cried. Simon Beck was like, everybody was in shock. But I couldn't tell Andre Mariner because the problem with Andre Mariner, he was closed. He was going on holiday. So when I got to St. George's, I took him privately and I said to him, look, are you unavailable on these days? He said, why? I says, because I'm refereeing the Champions League final. I would like you to come. It's me additional behind the goal. He said, I'm going to close my holiday. I'm going to the Champions League final. So we're going to announce, I think it was 5 o'clock in England on Sky Sports. And it was an amazing feeling. I'm in my bedroom and 5 o'clock there was, Mark Clattenburg has been appointed the Champions League final. I'm like, wow. And then my mobile phone just goes crazy. So you have that moment. And then the Euro was different because you're in a tournament. And it's weird being in a tournament because at the end you want to go home. You've been there a month. So it's an anti-climax. I know that sounds bizarre, but it feels an anti-climax because you start the pre-tournament with all the education programs and then you start refereeing. So I refereed, I think my first game was Belgium, Italy. Second game was Czech Republic and Croatia. And then I go in to do Swiss Poland in the first knockout. So you have nice... You haven't had nice games, no controversy in the games. And then you get told, look, if England don't qualify, that you have a chance of the final. So I'm dancing up and down in the bar, like I said before. Yeah. I'm the only Englishman happy. And then I remember going to the fan zone the next night. I said to me, guys, look, let's enjoy one night. Let's have a couple of beers. Let's go and enjoy one night. So we went to the fan zone in Paris to watch Belgium, Wales. And it was the most surreal thing I've ever had. The most... down I've ever felt because nobody expected Wales to beat Belgium and Wales would have affected my chance of being in the Euro because Wales were a part of England. So nobody expected Wales to qualify for the semi-final. And I'm like, when they beat Belgium, I left the fan zone in bits because my dream of doing the Euro final, one chance, now hinges on Wales.
So you need Wales to lose a semi?
Mm. Yeah, 100%.
You bet you were buzzing, weren't you?
Well, no, because I knew I had the chance. So I knew that hotel rooms would be difficult. So I booked me. I looked on booking.com.
Do you have to sort all that out?
Yeah.
No,
wait, what?
Well, yeah. Surely that's...
No,
that's,
no, no, you had to sort it
you're suddenly having to get on TripAdvisor. Yeah, that's ridiculous.
Yeah. That's outrageous. Yeah,
that's ridiculous.
I had to book my own flight. I had to book my wife's flights, book the whole hotel for my wife.
And what, expense it?
Well, no, because I looked for a hotel. No, I looked for a hotel, so I didn't get the final. I could get my money back.
I can't believe that. Yeah. I thought that when the like organising
not for a tournament, for the Champions League, it was completely different. UEFA solved everything.
Right.
For the Euro, it was completely different because it's a tournament. It's not a one-off game. I know it sounds like you're doing the final, so it's my responsibility. You got tickets. I think I got many tickets for the final, but I had to bring me. I flew my wife over, and then she watched the game.
You should all revolt. You refs, you should all come together. That's appalling.
There's too many strikes going on in the UK.
Yeah, true.
And you mentioned Ericsson as well as being one of the top referees at the time.
Yeah.
What do you think he was the best referee, or would you say you were above him at the time?
No, I used to look up to him. He was a good friend of mine, very, very talented referee. I never used to think I'm better than anybody else because you know what? You're only as good as your last match. Everybody could say, Mark Clattenburg was good today. I can guarantee next week, Mark Clattenburg's the worst referee in the world. It's just the way life is, you know? So you've got to take that. All I did was I tried me hardest. I was training every day. I lost, for example, when I first started in the Premier League, I was 93 kilo. In the end, I was 74. And I looked like a football player because I was training, I was running, I was fitter than the players. And when I had that much desire, because I wanted to be the best, not in the world, I just wanted to be the best. And I wanted to give my family something to be proud of, that look. All of this effort, in the end, there's a reward, you know?
How many hours a day were you training, roughly?
Two, three hours. But it was ridiculous. I used to get wrong for it. I used to do high-intensity sessions 3-4 times a week.
Wow.
And I would referee again. And I was telling you a story before. I remember I'm refereeing West Ham. Next day, I ran the Great North Run. And then 2 days later, I'm in Madrid refereeing at Real Madrid.
Yeah, it's too much.
Yeah. Legs gone.
Yeah. Oh, my legs. I couldn't even run. Yeah. I'm on the halfway line. Yeah. I remember one story. It was hilarious. And that was when I was fit. I remember Casillas got the ball, Real Madrid. He threw the ball, right? I'm running a full pelt. I think I just got past the halfway line and all of a sudden the big cheer went up. Ronaldo had scored. I thought, stop here. The ball's coming back.
That's amazing.
That is superb. Do you remember all of those games in full? You know those cup finals? Do you remember them? Can you? No.
What you end up doing is watching them back. I've never watched the Euro final back. I don't know why. I couldn't get a copy. Champions League, I watched.
Couldn't get a copy? Just go on YouTube or something.
I think me not, because you know what? My daughter, no.
Yeah.
Here's a true story. Right, you know what the problem was, right? I Sky Plus'd it. But you know what my daughter did? She decided she wanted to overrule it for bloody Peppa Pigs or something. But you know, that happens. It's family life, isn't it?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I could have got a copy. You know, sometimes the memories, I was frustrated after that match of the Euro final.
I would have thought, like, you know, they'd send you a nice little package, like with a DVD, you know, like a little, memento from the game, just to, you know, really.
You only ever got DVDs when you've had bad performances.
Right.
Well, I probably should have got one then.
Fans made one.
Always a club used to slide the DVD and watch that because you've had a nightmare.
The moment in your career, though, is probably the Champions League final. If you were to say one event, the Champions League final has to be like the jewel in the crown, doesn't it?
Yeah, because it's the biggest club game in the world, isn't it? So and to referee the two Madrid sides.
Yeah.
You know, I'm used to refereeing Premier League. I knew all the players. Okay, I knew a lot of the players. But you need luck. And people don't understand this luck. You know, it's not about skill. Skill's 90%. Pierluigi Collina used to say to me, there's no such thing as luck. Of course there's luck.
Yeah.
Because I'm refereeing Atletico Madrid. And I think I refereed them twice before the final of that season. And one of them was against PSV and it's 0-0 going and it has to go to penalties and they win, I think 14-12 or something ridiculous. So they win and they're happy with my performance. And then I go to referee them in a semi-final, which never happened before, ever. You referee a semi-final, Atletico Madrid against Bayern Munich. Guardiola was a coach of Bayern. Atletico win 1-0. No controversy, nothing in the match from a referee. I come off, said to me, guys, thank you very much for the season. We've had a great season. Let's enjoy the Euro. And then you're getting a phone call to do the final. That never happened before because normally...
Yeah, circumstance, isn't it?
Yeah, but normally they wouldn't let you referee one team in from the semi because the other team will complain. But Real Madrid were happy that I was refereeing because Real Madrid had always had good matches with me. I never caused any problems.
Right.
So from a balance point of view,
the clubs wanted me to referee the game.
Amazing. And you've got a memento of the occasion, the Champions League.
Yeah. I have the match ball. No. Klatter's tats, was it? Was that
is
the headline?
It?
Was it?
Yeah. Klatter's tats, what made you go for a tattoo? Because I know there's a lot of different things you could have done potentially. Yeah. Why a tattoo?
What was strange was nobody knew I had the Olympic Games, because I refereed the Olympic Games in 2012, the final, Brazil-Mexico. So I got that first done. I thought I'll get the rings. Why not? Some memento of my first achievement in football. And it was funny because I used to have to wear long sleeved after that because I used to try and cover it up so nobody could see it. And as I was wearing long sleeved, it was 45 degrees. And somebody said to me, are you ever going to wear a short sleeve? And I'm like, I can't. I always wear long sleeved. So, and then I thought after the 2016, I thought I'm going to get some memories. And what it did, and people will say, you know, you shouldn't get tattoos. And I'll say to everybody else, don't tell me what to do. I don't tell you what to do. That's fact. Yeah. I can do whatever I want. As long as it's legal, I'll do whatever I want. So I got these tattoos, and what it did, when you're having down days or you're having down moments, I used to just look and go, you know what? You did achieve something in life. Mm-hmm. So when you're having really down moments, which everybody does, it just gives us that little bit of, you know, thinking, wow, I did really do that, you know, and pinch myself because sometimes, you know, I didn't realize that I would ever reach the highest level I did.
So there's an Olympic rings tattoo to commemorate the moment in 2012. You've got the 2016 Champions League final. You've got a Champions League trophy.
Yeah.
Anything else we need to know about?
The Euro trophy.
Trophy.
I should have got that charity match on, shouldn't I?
Yeah, the side. Get KSI's face.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, go on. Get Speed on your bum or something.
I didn't even know who Speed was before the game. My daughter told us.
You knew after the game, though, didn't you?
And so it's three. You've got the hat trick.
I've got the three. So there's, I think most of them are here. Yeah, so I got that wonderful.
Oh, wow. Milan.
So, yeah, so Milan's here. The Euro, the mix is here. And up. You know what? You know, it's a chance to, you know, the worst thing you could ever do with tattoos is get a girl's name.
Yeah, that's forever, isn't it?
Yeah. How many you got?
The world comes down.
Yeah, also, they are forever. Like, if you're going to get tattooed with anything, that is an achievement that will last eternity.
Yeah, and, you know, people will always be negative about it. But for me, I see there's a positive that, you know, I started off in life, you know, difficult life, bullied at school. And then you come through and you realize that people can achieve something in life. And that's the most important thing for me. It doesn't matter who you are, where you are, what you come from. If you work hard, you can achieve.
Amazing. Mark, thank you so much for coming on. We really do appreciate it. This has been fantastic. I've really loved this episode. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hold on, I thought you said Tony Pulis's was better.
That's what I told you.
We said it's every day.
You do it every time. Everybody, thank you so much.